Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Judy Joy Jones Show. Thank you so much for tuning in. We have a really special guest tonight, so stay glued to your telephone or internet. Our call-in number is 347-326-9915. And tonight, I'm really happy to present a friend and a guest. His name is Curtis Olson, and Curtis is a bass player. He's a really good bass player, by the way. And he was a bass player for Ray Charles for several years and Buddy Rich, the drummer. And so I'm going to let him tell you about everything and all that he's doing now. And let me go ahead and bring him on the air. Hello, Curtis.
Yes.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thanks. Welcome to the Judy Joy Jones Show on Blog Talk Radio.
Judy Joy Jones Show. I love it. Can I just say JJJ?
Yeah, you can say that.
Okay. Right on. Okay.
So, go ahead.
No, I was saying hello because I'm on my cell phone, so if I cut out, I want your listeners to know that I'm still here with you, okay?
All right. Yeah, just keep your mouth right at the phone, you know. It's kind of easy to fade out, and we want everybody to hear everything you have to say. So,
okay.
Are you gigging somewhere around the Bay Area? You live in Oakland, California, right, Curtis?
Yes, I live in Oakland. And, okay, currently, as you know, like what you said earlier, I was on the road for like over 7 years with Ray Charles, and I did a lot of road gigs for a long time with other people like Pee Wee Ellis and Fred Wesley of the James Brown Horns. And so, but now I decided, okay, my thing now is producing in studio. So I started buying studio gear in the mid-90s.
Uh-huh.
You know, and saving all my money on the road, and all the cats on the Ray Charles band were pissed off at me. It's like, man, that tight wad. And it's like, I got a plan, Jack. I'm going home with some money, and I'm not gonna have to be out here forever. So,
right.
So now it's like, okay, I can finally use. I'm getting good at being an engineer producer, and so.
Right.
But I do have a couple of special gigs that I'm doing right now.
Okay.
I had the honor of getting the gig with Booker T. Jones. You know who he is. He was Booker T and the MGs.
Yep.
And he lives out here in the Bay Area. And so it's we have just a four-piece band, and it is off the hook hot. It is happening. And we're gigging around. And so if people want to know where we're playing, they can go to my – I got two websites. But the one with the schedule is the myspace.com/Curtis Olson.
Okay.
And that's and it's spelled Curtis Olson. Don't leave out the H. Olson. And it has all my schedule and stuff with Booker. And also, I'm playing with Pete Escovedo, you know, Pete Escovedo, Latin Jazz Orchestra.
Yeah.
And some of the gigs we're doing is with his daughter, Sheila E., and the family, Peter Michael, and Juan Escovedo. It's like the three kids and the father. And I'm telling you, there's nothing more fun than playing a gig with a family. Like, it is so fun. I'm telling you.
Oh, that's great. Well, you know, I have heard you talk about your time with Ray Charles, and I just have to ask you, would you be able to share just a little bit of that with the listening audience out here?
Sure. Okay. Well, ask me a question and
First of all, how did you become his Ray Charles bass player, Curtis?
Okay. It was, let me see. Okay. First of all, in 1979 is when I first got the gig. I was 21 years old, right?
Okay.
And I'm telling you, I was in a band previously, like a kind of a funk rock band, right, in Walnut Creek called Heather.
Okay.
And they needed a drummer. And so I got my buddy, Peter Turry, who's he's a drummer, right? And he was able to quit his job at Safeway and then become a full-time musician. And he just loved that. So then, his brother is Steve Turry, the trombone player on the Saturday Night Live band, and, a famous jazz musician. And Steve had the gig with Ray Charles, so got Peter the connection. Peter got the gig, and then the bass chair opened up, and he got me an audition, a direct line. And so, but that wasn't it. It wasn't like in the can. I sent him a record that I did with Bishop Norman Williams, like a bebop record, right? And this is in the days of albums, all right, kids? This is albums.
Right.
So now check this out. So they fly me down to audition, and there's like 20 bass players standing around the studio.
Oh, God.
With their basses in their hand. But so the band leader, Clifford Solomon, bless his soul, he's deceased now. He died like a couple months before Brother Ray. He was such a cool guy. Anyway, so he calls me up, so I start playing, and then he brings the tape back to Ray, and then Ray comes out. This is 1979. He had just gone through that divorce, right?
Okay.
And so he comes out, and it's like he has his gin and coffee in his hand, and he comes, and he's like, I'm just like tripping, like, what? Who is this dude? And it's like, so he starts auditioning me, and then after about four tunes, he cusses me out and starts yelling at me, right? And then he leaves. He splits. And didn't listen to any other bass players, right? And I'm like thinking, oh, man, I just screwed up. Okay, so then the guitar player, Eugene Ross, he leans over to me and he goes, man, that nappy-headed blind mofo loves your ass. And I'm like, Can I say those words on the air?
It's probably better if you put them like the initials. That's pretty cool.
Okay. So anyway, and I said, what are you talking about? He just cussed me out in front of everyone. And he goes, yeah, but that means he thinks you're worth cussing out.
How cool.
Well, not for me. I'm like shivering in my boots, you know?
Yeah.
So I didn't know if I had the gig. And then like a few days later, I got the call. It's like, hey, you got the gig. And then it was on the road. 9 months straight, and it was what an experience, you know. I mean, 21 year old. I was the second youngest cat in the band, and I'll tell you, like, here's a funny story.
Okay.
So the first time we're on the Ray had a plane then, but we would fly to an area, and then sometimes we'd bus it. So we were on the East Coast, and we were going from maybe. Somewhere on the East Coast to New York City, and it was late at night. It was after a gig. It was called a hit and run. You know, you play a gig, get on the bus, and then leave and go to the next gig. You know what I mean?
Yeah, okay. Sure.
So we're driving in New York City. I'm all excited, and I go to Clifford Solomon, the band leader. I said, hey, Clifford, how long till we get to New York City, man? And he goes, oh, about a pint, maybe a pint and a half. You know,
I love it.
But let me say this. He was a sweetheart. He like introduced me to people like Red Fox.
Oh, wow.
I mean, all kinds of people.
Great.
A lot of them are deceased now, you know what I mean? And they're just like great, great people. Now, there was another guy in the band, Rudy Johnson, a sax player. He was like a kind of a Coltrane-ish style player, what was that guy, Coleman. Anyway, he was very serious. He would practice like 4 hours a day on the road. So we were in Las Vegas, and we would do a show and then have like 2 hours off and do another show. So I'm backstage trying to practice, and I asked him, I said, Rudy, man, what should I practice? Tell me, you know. And he finally took me under his wing, and he goes, all right, here's what you do, man. He goes, learn how to play the blues in all 12 keys.
Okay.
Learn how to play the rhythm changes in all 12 keys.
Okay.
And this is what blew my mind, the next two things. He goes, then be able to play to a beautiful woman and seduce her through your instrument.
Wow.
And be
all
able
right.
to play, and then he said, and be able to play to a little child without scaring them.
Wow. Wow, what advice. Gosh, if you can do from one to the other, then you've got it made, right?
I guess I'm still working on it, you know?
You're still working on it.
I think I scare women and turn on kids. I don't know. No, I'm just kidding. It's just like, just in other words, then he gives me a couple of books, and it's like, you know, one of the books it took me like a year to go through. You know what I'm saying?
A year? Oh.
Yeah, to really do it well. It was from Berklee School of Music, Serious Chord Studies for Trombone, and, you know. Anyway, it was a great educational experience, and,
uh-huh.
but it was also very, very difficult because Ray Charles had this old school attitude. You know, people think, oh, you're on the road. Oh, you're vacationing, you get to visit everywhere. It's like, what are you talking about? You don't sleep, you eat, you know, like airplane food, like, you know, peanuts and cheese.
Oh, God.
Or whatever. You know what I mean? It's like,
you
never get enough sleep, you don't eat right. Sometimes it was like heaven, and sometimes it was like, as my math teacher used to say, H-E-O toothpicks.
Wow, God, yeah, I can understand that. You would think, you know, the outside people would think, oh, it would be pure bliss, right? But Curtis,
mm-hmm.
it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
You're here to say,
Well,
was
let me
close.
Say this. I want to say this. It was, I'm not downgrading the honor and opportunity I had.
Oh, sure.
Of playing with him because
every
night on stage musically, it was just like bliss, you know what I mean? Euphoria.
Yeah.
Learning and playing with this cat and all these great players. But the other 23 hours of the day, getting there, that was very difficult.
Very difficult. Well, do you, when you were with, you know, like Ray, was he right on top of every tiny thing? And like if you made one mistake, he'd,
no,
you know.
Man, yes. Why, did you hear about that?
Yeah, I kind of did.
Yeah. Okay. Let me say this. Here's what it was. If he would tell you something at a rehearsal or whatever,
uh-huh.
he would expect you to write it down in your music, right?
Oh.
And then he figured if you didn't, first of all, he had no respect for a person that could see, that didn't be able to, that couldn't read music, because he could read music. Theoretically and technically in his mind. He could dictate to someone a whole chart of, you know, big band chart or whatever, just from all in his head. I mean, so he didn't have any respect for someone who couldn't read music. Now, but it's like he didn't realize his charts have been around from like 1950, whatever. And there's like guys that like puked on them, and they're all torn up. They've been, you know, spilt booze on them and stuff.
Oh,
you know what I mean? And it's like
you couldn't
go up to them and say, "Hey Ray, I can't read this chart. It's you know, dirty or something." It's like what?
Right.
You know, you go crazy. So you had to, okay. If he told you something once, then if you messed it up on stage and didn't do what he had told you, okay, you would be cussed out in front of thousands of people on stage, and they're all out there in the audience saying, "That poor genius blind man, they're just not doing a good job." And he's like, wrong, you know, he's yelling. But it was like, it's a great lesson. So after you learn one time what not to do, it's I just learned to follow him, because he said, "All right, man, you got to follow me, because I sure can't follow you, man." You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
But I'm telling you, it was like it was a school not only musically, but also kind of conceptually.
Yeah.
Like, he saw stuff like almost like an optical illusion, you know, where you can't. Okay, he sees it one way, and it's so logical to him, right?
Right, right.
But if you're on the other side of that optical illusion, you're wondering, what's he talking about? You know, like
yeah.
he would say stuff like, "Man, why did you play that note?
Oh,
it just doesn't belong, man. I don't see why in the heck would you play it? It don't belong, man." You know what I'm saying? And
yeah.
then it would take me like 10 years later, I'd realize, oh, now I know what he's talking about. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. I do.
But
he was like I guess he just what you'd call a genius, right? He could hear it in his head and kind of expected everyone to get it, like as quickly as he did.
yeah, exactly. He was definitely impatient. But here's the deal. If you would write it down, which I quickly learned, write it
uh-huh.
down, and then follow him, then, you know, you would probably wouldn't be cussed out too many times in front of thousands of people.
Oh, God.
Right?
thousands of people. Whoa.
Well, I mean, you know, but let me say this. The drum
okay.
chair, the drummer, oh, I would, drummer, any drummer who's played with Ray Charles, it's like, God bless them. They should go to a monk monastery or something because, that was a hot seat. And,
okay.
And especially, okay, guitar players, too, he wanted the stuff so soft because he had this fear of becoming deaf or losing his hearing.
Oh,
and so
okay.
he would yell, turn down, man. I don't want to turn into a Helen Keller MF-er, man. Come on. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So what happened was he started in like, 48, right? 1948.
Yep.
So
yep.
In the 50s, what kind of equipment did they have? It was terrible,
electronic
gear. So he had this thing, even up to into the 2000s, he had this thing where no monitors. We could not have monitors on stage. And
what?
For the listeners out there who don't know what a monitor is, it's okay, you're playing, you know, a concert, and,
mm-hmm.
and it, a monitor is a speaker facing the musicians or singers where you can hear what you're doing so that you can play together and play well.
Okay.
Right? Okay, Ray, it's like, no monitors, man. No
oh my
monitors.
God.
And so, but let me tell you about this. It's like
mm-hmm.
the good players would develop like a sixth sense. Sometimes we'd be playing in a huge arena or something, and he'd be, 20 feet in front of me or whatever, and I'm just like trying to follow him, and I'm wondering, wow, are we together? What does it sound like? And then I would maybe hear a recording like that they
uh-huh.
recorded off the board. The next thing, it was like, shoot, that's the we it was like we were in a studio doing a record. It was tight as heck, you know?
Yeah, whoa. You had such a like an education within a short period of your life. I mean, you were young enough to really soak it in.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the show, they made a show about his life, Curtis. Would you say that was pretty accurate, or is it not at all?
What,
I mean, you
movie?
Would know because you traveled the world with him.
The movie?
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was very, very accurate because he was there through, I think, all of the filming. He was still alive.
Oh, I didn't know
oh,
that.
Oh, yeah, he was still alive. And I think Jamie Foxx just did a spectacular job of getting even his physical attributes and kind of how just how Ray would walk and kind of his gestures and, you know, hitting his ear or scratching himself or whatever. He had all
uh-huh.
that down. But, they probably – let me just say this. See, I didn't know Ray in those days. I started with him in 79. And at that point, he was not doing heroin anymore, right? He had quit that.
Oh, okay.
And so, but he was drinking, and he'd just gone through a divorce. So I don't think that was as good for him. And so he was a little bit more irritable at that time, right? However, later I went back with him in the 90s, like 94 through 98, through 97. And then he had mellowed out a lot, and he was very reasonable, and the gigs were real good, and it was just a lot better. But it was still hard on the road.
It was
28
hard.
People.
Yeah.
Oh, come on, 28 people in a bus.
Oh God!
You say you're sitting in a chair on the Ray Charles bus, and you go, "Okay, I'm going to go to sleep now, seat mate," and your seat goes back about an inch and a half. It's like, oh, okay, oh, yawn. I mean, you get an inch and a half lean back on your seat to go to sleep.
Oh, God. Oh, I couldn't. Oh, Lord. And you're expected to relax.
Well, you know, the worst part is then, okay, this is the fun stuff. You get off like a plane flight. You'd be on a flight for maybe 12 hours, get on a bus for a couple hours. Then you get off and you walk on stage and you're tired and like just, you know, disoriented and confused and hungry.
Sure.
And the first song Ray would call is like, one, two, three, four, you know, like fast bebop, you know, it's like waking your ass up. So, but it was very old school and very, I mean, the guy, he was just an amazing energy.
He was really a genius. Wouldn't you call him a genius, Curtis? I mean, he just had something that wasn't explainable. Like when he threw his head back and put his hands on that piano, it seemed like the whole world would just stop and they'd watch him. And he was like it. There wasn't anything else, you know. But he had a really hard time with heroin and all that, and he simply just kind of just let go of everything and went ahead and went with it. Wouldn't you say he went with the flow?
Well, let me say this. From what I gather, now remember, I started with him in 79. He had already given it up. And I know for a fact that he never did that stuff all the years that I was with him. He never did that, right?
He had given it up, So he just drank.
Okay, he went through that rehab like in the movie. That was very accurate.
Let me say this.
He is a very strong-willed person. I mean, he came from nothing. And you know, look, no father. His brother died in front of him when he was like five.
Hello?
And then he starts going blind. No, I think his brother died in front of him when he was like four or five. He starts going blind at five. By the time he's seven, he's completely blind. And then they send him away to a school in another state. And then I guess his mother died. And you know, so he came from nothing. So he expected the same type of intensity and passion and perfection from everyone. And if you were fast witted and remembered stuff, he loved it, and he liked fast people who could, you know, quickly do things. He was very impatient. He was very together. Like for instance, the whole time I played with him, I never saw him once spill a beverage. And he's blind. And you know why? Because he remembered exactly where he would put it. It would be the grand piano would come out. He never fell off a stage or whatever, you know, like Bing Crosby did.
Right?
Okay, here's what he did. He'd have people count the steps and everything. When he would set his beverage down, like at a rehearsal, it would be the left leg of the grand piano right next to it on the inside. He knew exactly where it was. So his mind was in charge. And he didn't have kind of patience for people who could see and weren't in charge. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. Like, well, were the Rayettes, like, with it, or did they sometimes, you know, how was that? Was he able to work real well with them, or?
Well, yeah, I mean, okay, first of all, you know what they say. I mean, to become a Rayette, you got to let Ray. You've heard that, right?
I have.
Okay. No, but let me say this now.
Okay.
If some of them, if they were like real kicking singer, he might let them stay in the band without giving it up. But okay.
You gotta be really good. Okay.
He was hard on those girls. But see, check it out. They were like, okay, he wanted sisters who could sing like gospel, blues, and jazz, and pop.
Sure.
And get these. He was, some of his harmonies would be, you know, he'd have like a flat 13 chords on the vocal or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's like, but usually singers like that, they don't read music and write it down, right?
So yeah, they don't.
And so, man, I saw him once, this customer lets out of the rehearsal. Well, it embarrassed me. It was so bad. It was like, because he would spend time teaching a song, and they maybe would record it or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And this is where reading music came in handy because, you know, a musician, we could just write it down, read it, and play it
sure.
the time, even if we forgot it, right?
Okay, right.
But the poor girls, once Ray wanted this tune to go through, and it's like they kind of messed up a little at rehearsal, and he just cussed them out so bad that I was embarrassed, and I don't get embarrassed.
God.
And then he said, all right, I ain't ever doing this tune again.
Oh, so, gee. That was it.
And it's like then that guilt trip was like, oh, gee. It was, you know. But then sometimes he would be very, very almost nice. No. He was cool. Let me say this. I got to say this. Hold on. Musically, he was extremely giving, very giving.
Uh-huh.
And that's what people felt from him. And so you would kind of forgive him for maybe the rough edges. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly. And, oh, yeah, I do. Because I was listening to Jar Jar on my mind, and I was just listening to it. Yeah, I know exactly what you're saying. He just... It was hard for him kind of dealing in the world and the spirit world where his songs came from. And but he did really good. I mean, he's such an icon. So many people love Ray Charles. Is the part in the movie with all his women. I mean, Ray Charles in the movie, they made it look like, oh, man, he just had a woman everywhere he went. Is that really
it? Yeah. In fact, they downplayed a lot of that stuff. One time, one of his valets told me, I don't know, this cat used to, like, exaggerate.
Uh-huh.
But this one of his valets told me, he goes, man, I said, what's wrong, man? And he goes, I'm so damn burned out and tired. I said, what are you talking about? He goes, man, I can't keep up with this dude, man. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, he's got, like, three different women a day. I got to pick one up at the airport, make sure they don't see the other one in the hallway, and get the other one in the Ray Led. And it's like, three a day, James.
A day. You go,
know,
Ray.
Why doesn't he share, man? But, think about it. What else is he going to do? Is he going to go sightseeing after, you know,
exactly.
after a gig? Come
Very
on.
Good. I mean, because he couldn't really. Yeah, really. So that was his thing. Yeah, women.
Well, that
women
was,
on
yeah,
his mind,
was,
like charge on the mind.
Well, you know what? Also, let me say this.
Okay.
A couple of times when I saw him become, let's just say, a little bit vulnerable in the tone of his voice to me, maybe
uh-huh.
out of seven years, I heard that from him maybe twice.
Oh.
And one time it was because I mentioned that my mother-in-law had passed away, right?
Oh.
And that I wanted some time off, and I heard him just, that was his weak spot, his mother. He loved his mother. She was what gave strength and guidance. And
okay.
Maybe, you know, so that was his weak spot. Now, maybe he went a little overboard with the womanizing, but I think he loved women, but it was also, you know, when you're a big star like that, come on.
Oh, God. Yeah, he was so huge. I mean, he was big every place he went. It wasn't like he was... Who's that? Everybody knew Ray Charles almost from day one, you know, and
well,
he had lots to live up to because, you know.
I know. Okay, we think it's from day one, from our day one, but think about it. He came from nothing. That dude probably played more gigs, traveled more miles than any human being on the face of the earth. I mean, the guy was flying every day somewhere to work. And then, he wanted to work almost every day. He worked as much as possible for the 50 plus years that his career spanned. And I think he recorded like 150 records over 50 years. That's three a year. I mean, come on. Like sometimes I do a record with some of my clients and it takes, you know, God, we're working on, maybe he has a baby and it's like takes 2 years to do a record and it's great and everything. It's like Ray did three a year.
God, he was just, you know, Ray was famous. He was on fire, right? Wouldn't you say, Curtis? Or, yeah, he was burning.
Oh, totally. All the way through. And even when his, after, you know, he died out as far as being, let's say, hit, you know, having current hits on the radio in the 60s.
Right.
okay, maybe in the 70s or whatever, he just kept hitting and working and working and touring and touring and building up the following. And then finally, it kind of came back as this, like, what do you call it, retro thing where it's like, wow, this is fresh. And I mean, he kept a big band on the road for years.
For years.
Yeah,
you know, Ray Charles, to me, he was like bigger than life. You know, when I went to a Ray Charles concert, I expected bigger than life, perfection, you know. I mean, I don't even know how to put it in words. He just had that magic where he threw his head back, he touched the piano, and you were just in a different world.
Yeah.
And,
in fact, can I say something?
Sure.
Now, Joy, you hit the nail on the head. In fact, if he was in a room, let's say there's you're in a room with maybe 15 people, and Ray was one of them.
Uh-huh.
Everyone in that room, eyes would be on him just because of his energy and intensity and frickin' passion and enthusiasm.
Huh.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. They were just there. Oh, I do. Yeah.
Everyone's eyes would be on him. Because probably cats like maybe Jimi Hendrix might have been like that or whatever. I never met him. But, you know, it's like there's these special guys that just have this gift, and then they give it out musically. And it's part of their personality, too. And, I mean, people like that, you would let them maybe bend or break the rules a little because they gave so much. You know what I mean?
They gave so much, yeah. Rachel, okay. Well, was he really, I mean, you know, I know he was married, right, Curtis? I know he was married, and he was very devoted to his wife. But I guess, when you're on the road, you're on the road, right?
Wait, who said that he was married? Did you watch the movie? Come on.
Yeah, I did.
Was he naive? Shoot.
Really did. I mean,
let me say this. He was married until a certain time. They went to a divorce. And okay, so
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, went through a divorce. I got the gig in 79, right? And I think right before that, first of all, in 78, he got that award from the state of Georgia, where remember they had like banned him from the state.
Oh yeah.
Then they made him, you know, a Georgia the state song and gave him some honor, right?
Right.
That was 78. Now I think one of the dudes in the band told me like, he had just gone through the divorce. I don't know what year it was, but he said, man, last tour, he goes, when he would be singing Crying Time.
Oh,
that,
yeah.
He said he would really be crying.
Oh, God.
And
that's why we felt it.
Yeah. I mean, he had that tone of his voice. Sometimes we'd get to a gig and then maybe the band would start something off. And then when he would come in singing, the place would just, everyone would stand on their feet and applaud just when he sang his first couple of words, because it just had that Ray Charles kind of sad tone of passion and intensity.
Right.
Just give you chills, you know what I mean?
Yeah, he was just like his soul.
Yeah.
That's really, and so how could you ever get mad if he got mad at you? I mean, here you know, you're with this genius of all time.
No, believe me, you could get very mad on the road. It's very difficult being out there after you ain't slept or ate, you know, eating a good meal for a few days, and you're driving in a bus for 12, 14 hours. But let me say this: when I saw the movie, right?
Yeah.
I went to, right when it came out, like the second day was up, I had to go to the snack bar and get a stack of napkins. I was crying, I was laughing, and I felt so let's say inspired. And honored that I performed with him, and I forgave, and just
everything
that I thought was you know, made me angry or whatever or
right.
uncomfortable. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
it
I
all
do.
Left right
totally
there.
Do. He was just a genius, and he had to get the music out and whatever it took to get that out. You know, that's what he had to do. I mean, Ray Charles is like this icon. You know, he's just going to go on for centuries. We don't even know how long. And
yeah.
I think he just had that magic. Whatever it was at that moment, I mean, he was just his voice. It goes into you. You know, it's not like this normal kind of like singing. No, Ray Charles kind of went okay, I'm going to go in, I'm going to take over. I'm going to take your heart, right?
Yeah.
And he did. And
he did. Can I say something about what you said? Okay.
Uh-huh.
Now, remember in the movie when they said at first, like when he was struggling to get a hit, like on Atlantic Records, they said, Ray, you got to get your own style. You sound like Nat King Cole or Charlie Brown, right?
Okay. Yeah.
So now then he did get his own voice, right? And it was like an R&B kind of a little bit more intense, stronger vocal thing. Now, check this out. Later, he played every style of music, and we would end up headlining every type of like concert festival in the world. Like we would headline jazz festivals, of course. We would headline country music festivals, like three-day festivals in Fargo, North Dakota, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And we would headline gospel festivals, blues festivals, and pop festivals, and worldwide. And we played the same stuff at every show.
Wow.
He did everything funk. I mean, the cat was funky. He played bebop, blues, some Latin and ballads. Oh, unbelievable.
Yeah, he just threw it. Yeah. He was born with that gift, wasn't he? You know, without Ray Charles, I don't think America would, you know, it's kind of like that song, America, America. He's such part of everybody. You know, I think.
Yeah,
that's why. Well, what about Buddy Rich? You worked for he was a genius, right? Wasn't he?
He was or wasn't? What was your question?
He was a genius, right? Or am I wrong? Buddy Rich.
No. Let me say this. First of
all right.
I really don't. What is the definition of a genius? I mean, let me say this. These are like guys who are very, very, very gifted and innovative, maybe, and that worked every freaking day. And part of Ray's success and probably Buddy's as well was that their work ethic. They wanted to play and work every day and tour every day. Yeah, from nothing. They start from nothing, playing little high school gymnasiums, and pretty soon they're in, you know, huge, you know. But now, okay, as far as Buddy Rich, he was innovative and influenced like lots of drummers. But let me say this.
Mm-hmm.
He was all natural, and he was musically illiterate. He didn't know what a whole note was or half a note or any of that.
No.
But you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
And he couldn't read music. However, he was just a phenomenal player. I think his parents had a vaudeville act, and he was like on the road when he was 18 months old. And at 3 years old, he had his own portion of the show.
Uh-huh.
With drumsticks. His own portion of the show.
3 years old. Yeah.
3 years
well,
old.
I guess he had a right to do whatever Buddy Rich wanted to do, right?
Well,
I mean,
okay. Yes, no. But, I mean, you know, when it's funny now, those old band leaders, like I was talking to Fred Wesley, the trombone player, and he played with James Brown. He was James' musical director for a while, and he did the
I love James Brown.
Funkadelic. He did the Funkadelic gig. And then I think he also played with, like, Duke Ellington, and I think he played with the Ray Charles Orchestra for a while. And so we were on the road together with Pee Wee Ellis in Europe, and then Fred said to me, he goes, man, it's crazy. These cats like Ray Charles and James Brown, he goes, they're so hard and mean to their band, cussing dudes out. But you know what? He goes, every night the band played their hearts out for them. They do their best. And it sounds great every night.
Every night.
That's that old school. Not this new, like, politically correct, like, hi, is everything all right? Would you like a bottle of water?
Really?
Hey, you're going to pass out on stage, Jack. You know what I mean? That old school thing. And I thought that everybody just cussed everybody out. I mean, but Buddy Rich, that was worse for me. I mean, I remember on the bus a couple of times starting about 5 or 6 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
My stomach, and I'm 22, 23 years old, my stomach would start getting upset. And I'm thinking, that was the first sign of stress in my whole life.
Huh. So Buddy was really a hard... he was a taskmaster. I mean, he really put you to the test, right, Curtis?
Oh yeah, yeah. He was hard, and he was kind of not crazy, but when he died of a brain tumor, he had a brain tumor.
Yeah.
And then I realized, I oh shit, maybe that explains why
he
cussed out the band in front of 2,000 people at Disneyland or something. You know what I mean?
God, who knows? Who knows what's in their mind? Yeah, maybe the brain tumor. We can put it off at that, you know.
Maybe it has started already. I don't know. But let me say this.
Uh-huh.
Now that I look back, it's like I'm so, like, proud and also honored to have played with cats like that. And they're both deceased right now. And, you know, people give their right arm. In fact,
oh, God,
my father
yeah.
said that. My father said that when I was 21, he goes to Vegas to hear me. He lifts up the curtain and he goes, "Kurt." And I go, "Dad, what are you doing?" It's like, "I got your mom. We're celebrating our anniversary." Right?
Wow.
So then he told me, he said, "You know, there's guys twice your age that would give their right nut to have this gig."
That's right.
And he said, and I'm saying, "Wow, yeah, I guess you're right. But, wow, look at that chick." No. You know, I'm like 21. I'm going on. But later I realized how great it was. But it was hard. It was hard.
Yeah, were like out on the road. You were only, you know, you were in your early 20s. And, I mean, who did you turn to but the band? So if they were in a bad mood, right, they would just say, "Get off the bus," or whatever, you know. You didn't really have anybody at that point, right?
No, I was smart enough to not be cocky and like egoed. I went to the older guys and respected them, and they took me under the wing and taught me and helped
mm-hmm.
me. You know, and some of the guys, okay, it's like, all right, buy this guy a fifth of Black Velvet, buy this guy some Cutty Sark, buy this guy some Jim Beam. You know what I mean?
Right,
and,
right.
You know, and I did that kind of shit. And but the thing was, showing them respect, and then that. They took me under their wing and would help me. And for instance, let me give you an example of
uh-huh.
a conversation once on Ray Charles' plane. There was two sax players talking. Okay, wait, no, one sax player talking. Rudy Johnson. He had a very proficient, great player. You know, and he was a tenor player, and he could play fast bebop stuff, and you know, just amazing chops. And so he was having a discussion with a couple people on the plane, and he was saying a bunch of technical stuff, right? And I'm kind of listening. And then there was this other sax player named Donald Wilkerson, who he didn't really know music theory or anything, but Bray would have him solo on the ballads.
Oh.
And he would talk to people through his sax, like, and then kiss, like, whatever, you know, through the saxophone. And, you know, he would always get applause, and it was like, so he's trying to, these are the two opposite sides of the spectrum of music.
Mm-hmm.
So Rudy's saying stuff like, all right, every chorus, here's what you should practice. On every every major chord, do a sharp 11 the first time around, a 9. Dominant chord, you do a flat 13,
mm-hmm.
Sharp 9, flat 9, blah, 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 right? And so then Donald Wilkerson, who's trying to sleep, he gets up and he goes, "Man, shut the heck up." He goes, "There's only two scales, C and C sharp."
Right.
You know what I mean? In other words, it's like he just played from his heart and the other guy played from his mind.
Exactly.
That was
There's a big difference. Ray was from the heart and the rest, and, you know.
No, Ray, actually, Ray was from heart and mind at the same time.
And mind.
That's why it was so bad. Yeah, yeah. He realized both sides.
I got
no
it.
Question.
So that's where his genius was, both, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
He was able
yes.
to hook into both. And most
yes.
of them can't, you know, like their heart or their mind. And it's like Ray was able to do both, which
mm-hmm.
made it hard. Right, to be his
mm-hmm.
bass player. God, you know, actually, Curtis, you are one in a million. I mean, how many people could have ever kind of auditioned for that and gotten the gig? Not many. You know, it's
well,
like...
Well, I think there's a long line of Ray's business right now at the unemployment office in L.A. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. The bad joke.
No, I believe it. No, I mean, really. I mean, you actually were picked out of many, many, many. And I think Ray knew, you know, he said, well, okay, this guy's got a real talent for the bass, and I'll pick him. And, you know, you were able to kind of hook into whatever he needed. And that's why we have you as our guest, really.
Well, thank you.
But I know you do a lot
right.
of recording in your studio, right, for different people?
That's what I'm doing now is production, and I've kind of become, instead of just a musician, now I've put my energy into being a producer and also engineer. And in the mid-90s with Ray, I started saving my money and buying music gear, and I have a very nice studio, and that's what I do now. I'm putting this energy and experience for other people who want to do a great recording and launch their career. And it's really been nice because I've let go of the, you know, control freak stuff that I had in my 20s, right?
Right.
And I mean, I've done records where I'm in charge of every note. I write every song and every, you know. Now I'm at the point where, what do you want? What are you going for? What's your personality? What's your goal?
Sure.
And it's really it feels very good to me to help someone gain their personality and document their life musically, you know, and have them so happy that, you know, it makes them, let's just say, feel fulfilled musically, and sometimes even their self-esteem and personality. It's just when you do something that you love and it's good and other people approve of it, there's nothing else like that because it's a gift you're giving out.
Right, right. Well, what again, could you give your website, Curtis, so that people who might want to record something could call you?
Yes. Okay. They can go to my website, www.curtisolson.com, and I have my email address there, and it's spelled CURTISOHLSON. Again, CURTISOHLSON. And then there's contact information there. You know, I'm into it, but only with serious people.
Right.
And I have some very satisfied, happy clients that have come back for, you know, I'm producing two and three albums on the same artist, and it's just it's a nice feeling and relationship.
Now, you're in Oakland, right? Oakland,
yes,
California?
Oakland. Yes.
Now, could you actually help people that want to record something over the internet, do it over the phone or internet, or does it have to be at your studio?
Well, no. In fact, that's good that you're bringing that up. Now, like one of my clients lives in Atlanta, a guitarist named David Grant, and we're starting his second album right now. And we did, okay, he came here initially, and then we got everything together and the whole plan. Mm-hmm. I write out, help a client write out a plan. And then we did a lot of it over the phone with, with emailing and, you know, the software we have now. It's pretty amazing what you can do, and you don't always have to be in the same room at the same time. However, it is nice for human contact, at least at first, to get it going and to feel the vibe and energy from a person. You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and that way you can kind of go, oh, well, this is a go, or we drive together or whatever. Yeah,
yes.
Absolutely. And you're very accessible through your Oakland studio. And I know you have a lot of people that come to you, right? From all over. And if anybody wants to contact you, they can do that.
Through my website, CurtisOlson.com.
Right.
CURTISOHLSON.com.
Absolutely. And I think... yeah, it's all going to be through the internet, through the computer, but we still like to have that kind of personal, you know, especially recording artists that are doing music. They want to be in the studio with the person that understands their music, whatever. And so how about, is it very expensive to actually record with you, Curtis, or
well,
what is
okay,
that?
Let me say this. Being now that the digital revolution and everything, computers, the expenses
sure.
for recording has come way down. And
okay.
Do you have to hang up or something? Is it?
No, that's fine.
No,
go ahead. No problem.
Yeah, the price. I mean, what I do is I have prices that are let's just say in line with my experience and ability, but also with what the competition is out there. So, I mean, there's people charging, you know, on Craigslist, you see so many advertising, I'll do a song for $25. It's like, come on,
really.
You're not going to get anything. But it is way less expensive now. And also, the great thing is with digital editing and, like, auto-tune and some of these plugins and stuff, I can edit somebody to make them sound, by bringing in other good musicians and myself helping them out and arrange their song. Literally, if somebody can come over here and hum what they want, I
uh-huh.
can make them sound like a freaking top quality album with the editing and knowing what to do, what you're going for sound-wise and music-wise. But the most important thing is to capture an artist's personality, their own sound. And that's the most important thing that I try to do. Instead of trying to direct and change someone, I try to adapt to their needs and their goals and then just help them achieve that.
Yeah, you know, I hear that. I had a friend that she was like Hispanic music and she thought nobody could record it. Nobody would understand it, but I told her there are people, you know, that will. And, you know, you're not going to be making a judgment. Well, this is Hispanic. I don't. You're not going to do that, right, Curtis? You're going to go ahead.
In fact, one of my, I think, what from my mother being such a kind of giving, high consciousness person, I got the side of her that you never, when somebody's being sincere, trying to learn or trying their hardest, it's only support and giving and never like laughing or putting down, you know what I mean?
And sure.
When you're in the studio, you're under a microscope, you know, people,
oh, God,
it can scare people. I mean, it took me 2 solo albums before I stopped getting nervous when the record button went on.
Oh,
in the
God,
olden days
no.
with 2-inch tape. Yeah. So, you know, I try to be very supportive and also constructive but honest.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
now
well,
I'll edit the heck out of it and make them sound great.
Yeah, well, no matter. You just edit it. And they're going to sound like Madonna, no matter what they do, right?
You know, I'm telling you, it's so great now. And I've gotten so good at that, and it's so fun. But that you try to go for a good take, raw and au naturel, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But come
and
on.
Like
I mean,
Ray Charles, he was just a genius. He didn't have to try. He just was, you know.
No,
Ray
let me say
Charles.
He did try. He tried hard, and he worked. He was a workaholic.
Was he?
Oh, yes. Every day he was working.
Oh, I didn't know.
He would book. Like when we went to Europe, we would work almost every day. It was exhausting and crazy, but that's how he wanted it. And that's why he, you know, was popular and famous. I mean, if he was lazy, we wouldn't know who he was.
Absolutely. But he
was a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
But he was one of those 1 in 10 million types that, you know, he had the gift and this a passion and gift for music, and he developed it.
He did, you know, and I think, you know, looking at his lifestyle, you wonder how, you know, because he was a heroin addict, and then he got off that. He went through all of the things that the human being can go through But his genius never faltered. And I think, you know, to myself, well, he could have done it without the heroin, the women, the booze. But on the other hand, I think he was very, very human. And he needed what he needed. Right, Curtis?
Yeah. He was vulnerable. And maybe that, let's not justify those kind of vices, but let's just say maybe everything contributed to what he was. However,
exactly.
He was even better after he gave up heroin than when he was on it. I mean, some people might, you know, have different opinions about that, but
sure.
In other words, he was Ray Charles regardless, and it was probably his personality that his strife, his struggle in life. Great music comes from struggle, you know.
It does.
That's why if you go to Hawaii, I mean, I love Hawaii, right? I love to go to Maui, but
sure.
If I can listen to the radio there and it's like, oh, this is terrible. Their life's too nice here. It's like everything's beautiful and the major key.
Everything's
like,
beautiful.
Come on, here's some
you know
blues,
better.
You know what I'm saying?
So, yeah, I do. That doesn't make great music at all.
Yeah. No. But,
it's not reality. No way.
Yeah. But I love, you know, going there and everything. I mean, but...
Sure. But
yeah.
Ray Charles, he'd been there, been back, and been there, and been back, and he just let it all go. I mean, he had nothing like a censor. He just let it all go. You know, that's what is amazing to me, that you were picked out of all the people. You know, it's like, okay, I'll take him, Curtis, you know, for my bass player, because he heard something. You know, he did hear something. And
well, can I say part of what
sure.
It was I read well, but I was also into like jazz bebop, and I sent him a bebop record that I'd done. And,
oh.
But I read very well, and
uh-huh.
And if you were quick witted and quick, you know, with your, you know, if you were fast minded, you know, your mind worked fast. He loved that.
Sure.
And luckily, I could keep up with him most of the time. I mean,
most of the time.
Yeah. I mean, that dude was fast and impatient. I mean, like a champion chess player. He used to have chess tournaments at his home, and
oh.
You know, he conceived of every type of theory in
oh.
his mind. You know, the guy was very, very smart.
He was out
but,
there.
Yeah, I mean, just think of how hard his life was. And then everyone's kissing
oh.
your behind. Everyone's kissing your behind, so you don't have a threshold or a barometer to
no,
determine reality. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
So
yeah, because everybody
weird.
Says you're great, no matter what do you do. And,
exactly.
You know, maybe you didn't do so great, right? Yeah.
Well, no, not just that, but, like, let's just say being a little mean to somebody or impatient with somebody, and... they would still forgive you or be nice, even though if you weren't a big star, somebody would say, hey, man, what are you talking about? You just hurt my feelings, or you were not nice there.
Oh,
nobody
yeah.
ever said those things because it was all like, he's a multimillionaire, and you know what I mean? So
yeah.
That was a little probably different, but, you know.
Well, you know, actually, Curtis, I think most people on Earth would give their life to have had the talent you had, that whatever made Ray Charles go, okay, he's it. You know what I mean? I mean, most people would do anything to have had that. And you were very, very special because somewhere along the line, you had something that made him open his mind and ear to you. And you know, I think that's pretty cool because I don't know what it's like to be a musician. I'm not. But I do know that whenever they're trying to kind of like get out there, go on the road, go on the world tour, they need people that are kind of like in their space. And
yeah.
You were. And I think that's amazing because there were so many people that could have been, but you were it. And maybe at times you think, oh, I wish I wasn't, but you were. So sharing that with everyone is a great gift.
Thank you.
Yeah. I feel
and
like...
Let me say something to you.
All right.
You're Okay, you say you're not a musician. Well, you are
No.
a radio personality, and you're helping enable musicians such as myself, spread their message or word or whatever. And so you're doing something good for music as well. So thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, well, I love music, and I love everybody that does really great music, like Ray Charles. I grew up with him. He was the first concert I ever went to. And so, of course, he's in me. You know what I mean? It's like, Ray Charles, all right. I just grew up with him. And I'm sure a lot of people out there listening at Blog Talk Radio. Curtis, I want to tell you, thank you so much for being our guest tonight. And just tell everyone that your show and our show is available on Blog Talk Radio at Judy Joy Jones Show. .com, and it's in the archives. They can download it, they can upload it, whatever, but we would love to share you. And also, you were one of the spotlighted shows of tonight, so we have extra special listeners. So and also, one more time, could you give your email or your website?
Yes. Okay, I have two websites right now. www.curtisolson.com, which has my contact info for serious prospective production clients, or and that's spelled curtisolson.com.
Okay.
And then also I have a MySpace with all my schedule that I'm playing with Booker T. Jones and also Pete and Sheila Escovedo. And that is www.myspace.com/Curtis Olson. And so between the two, I mean, thank you. And I want to thank all of your listeners. And I hope that people enjoyed this as much as I did.
Yeah, I'm sure we all did. And if you, the archives are available for anyone that wants to, listen to them. They're free, Judy Joy Jones Show, blogtalkradio.com. And so anytime you'd like to hear whatever went on that you couldn't kind of be there for, please feel free to go ahead and go in the archives. And thank you, Curtis. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, and thank you very much. And keep your show up. I love it, okay?
Thank you, Curtis. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
Oh, My heart aches with love for you. Afraid and shy, I let my chance go by. A chance that you might love me too. You give your hand to me, and then you said goodbye. I watched you walk away beside that lucky guy. Oh,